You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter. And a beautiful Davis day. I can't say bright and sunny because it's overcast. And Don, it's sprinkled.
It rained very little, but it rained this morning. And it's actually where I am looking out the window, looking at a squirrel going through my guava tree. It's also raining a little bit right now. You stay dry out there, sweetie. And we were not really expecting much out of this, but when I got up at sunrise this morning, there was a beautiful rainbow off to the west because some showers were passing over us. And what does a rainbow mean? It means you're between the rain and the sun. So today, Wednesday, October 16th, as we are recording the show, there's actually a 30% chance of showers, mainly before 3 p.m., mostly cloudy. Yep, I'd agree with that. Gradual clearing and a high near 77. Let's go to WeatherSpark and see what the average high is at this time of year. 76. Pretty darn close, if you ask me. Tonight, it'll be 50 degrees. I think that's the second time we've hit 50 so far. A light wind Thursday, sunny with a high near 72, west southwest wind on Thursday, the day of the broadcast, 5 to 11 miles an hour. And here's the important part from a gardening standpoint. The wind is going to shift to the north in the afternoon. What?
there are fire warnings out. Fire weather warnings.
Red flags,
yeah. And I know that's usually hot and dry and windy, but it's not hot.
But it is dry and is going to be windy. And this is probably the first major north wind event we've had in quite a while, actually. This happens every year. If you move to the Sacramento Valley, you discover something when you move here, which is that the north wind that we get here is a October and November phenomenon. Happens at least once or twice every October and November. One memorable year, just a few years ago, we had five of them in a seven-week period. And they're important to gardeners because aside from the winds being gusty, and we are talking about Thursday night, northwest wind 14 to 23 miles an hour with gusts as high as 43 miles an hour. And Friday, sunny with a high near 73 with north winds 22 to 26 miles an hour with gusts as high as 44 miles an hour. So a 24-hour period there of significant dry wind. And it's that low humidity along with those gusts that matters to gardeners. A lot of you are planting things right now, little vegetable plants, flowers. You may have scattered some wildflower seed or some grass seed. You will need to water the seed 2 to 3 times a day while that north wind is blowing for that roughly 1 to 2 day period, morning, midday, again, late afternoon. You probably cannot overwater young seeds that you've just planted and the seedlings that you've put in. This is really important. People are planting lettuce and broccoli and all that kind of stuff. And it's very important to keep those little seedlings watered. In the ground, a newly planted vegetable plant should be fine under normal conditions with one good soaking each morning. But if it's really dry and windy, water it again early to mid-afternoon, even again late afternoon if you have to, because that humidity is going to be in the 10%, 15% range, and that will dry these little seedlings out very, very quickly. They're fine with the temperatures, and everything else about this weather is fine for the things you've just put in. You just got to keep a real close watch on the watering. Then that north wind is out of here. Friday night, it'll be 50 degrees and mostly clear. Saturday, sunny with a high near 78. Saturday night, dropping down to 47, which is an important data point from the summer vegetable standpoint. Sunday, sunny with a high near 79. Sunday night, also 50 and clear. Monday, sunny, high near 79. Monday night, also 50. Tuesday, sunny with a high near 80. So a few degrees above average as we get into early next week. That 49 degree, 47 degree, those night temperatures that I'm reading there, that's not anything to worry about in terms of harming your summer vegetables. What it will affect is the ripening of the summer vegetables, which tends to slow down as the temperatures drop below about 50, 55 degrees. So they'll continue to ripen properly, except for two things. One, it's raining a little bit. That rain could cause bacteria and mold and stuff to get in. If there's any break in the skin of your tomato or your pepper, has been injured by a pest of some sort, the rapid decomposition by those types of things can be disturbing. So it's not a bad idea if it's got some color and it's not fully ripe on the vine, but you're a little worried about those night temperatures and that moisture, to go ahead and pick it and bring it in, let it ripen on the counter. And then the dew point, which we've reached a few times, has a similar effect as a little bit of rain, which is that moisture. The moisture on the surface of the fruit, especially those tomatoes that are way down inside the vine, you know, that are surrounded by damp foliage, they may spoil as they're ripening, which means you should put a close watch and perhaps pick them, wipe them off, bring them inside, put them on the counter. Again, it's going to be really dry Thursday, Friday, so you may not have to worry too much about that aspect of the weather. I don't like to brag.
Yes, you do.
But over the last week, I've picked approximately 200 tomatoes. And I'm processing a lot of them, giving them to staff and so forth. And we can talk about why I have so many late season tomatoes, because people keep saying things when I post Instagram pictures like, not fair, or how'd you do that? Well, the answer is,
you kept watering. That's kept how watering. You did
That's
that.
Right. And I went back, and I've every summer, at the end of the summer, I collate all the data from the summer temperatures and dew points and the ET rate so that I have them in a folder, because I can gather that data quite readily now, thanks to the Simis weather stations. And I looked back at that 3-week period that began on July 1 and ended about July 25th, but there were a couple of cooler days in there. All of those days, except for one or two, were well above average. The ET rate was anywhere from 10 to 30% above average, certainly in the early part of the month. I kept deep watering, at least 2 gallons per plant per day, and much longer when it was going to be extremely hot, just to make sure that the whole zone was watered and they were growing like crazy. That was what I went by. The, you know, plant performance is your best guide to whether you're irrigating correctly. And they were flowering very well in August. It was substantially cooler in August as usual, but even more so than usual this year. So there was really good fruit set, especially the middle of August. And we use our 7-week metric for harvesting fruit. That means that in late September, early October, I had a lot of fruit. And there were four, I've mentioned this before, but I'll give you a little update. Four that I planted on July 15th. And I just picked about 40 from It's a Keeper, which is a really good late ripening and late holding tomato. 30 or 40 from Bodacious. And the big surprise to me was Chef's Choice Purple, which I didn't even stake. I mean, I stuck this poor plant in the ground without a cage or a stake because I had it and there was a drip emitter there. I thought, you know what? Fine. Let's see how you do. I hadn't grown that variety before. I just counted 50 fruit. 50, that's 50 fruit on Chef's Choice Purple, at least 12 ounces each. A number of them are a pound and they're just ripening now. In fact, I'm a little concerned about the rain this morning. And I may have to go out and pick some of those and bring them in and ripen them on the counter. But July 15th, 50 fruit in the second week of October. and this one, I'll tell you, the Chef's Choice series, I really didn't mean to go on this long digression. We'll come back to normal in a moment, folks. The Chef's Choice series has been outstanding. They're huge fruit. They're very meaty. They slice well, and they're very productive. Chef's Choice Orange is the best of the batch so far. But there's about 7 or 8 colors now. The purple isn't really purple. It's just a darker sort of burnished red, a little more towards the brown end of things. And they love to call that purple. Huge fruit. They do soften quickly. So the Chef's Choice series has been very consistent. Almost all of them have been very good performers for me so far, but they do vary as to how well they hold up to weather. Yeah, Chef's Choice Orange, absolutely perfect. Tougher skin, firmer texture. It's a tomato that I will probably be picking out of there even into November. The Chef's Choice Purple, and I found the same thing with their red and their pink. They soften quickly. So you got to pick them and process them. And you got, you know, 40 or 50 of them to deal with, a fair number of which are spoiling on the ground. So I do recommend gauging. I do recommend staking, but it is rather remarkable that a hybrid indeterminate tomato planted in the middle of July is producing this much fruit in the middle of October. There may be places you're living where you would have been below 55 by now, below 50 even, so you wouldn't be able to do this. But anywhere in the Sacramento Valley, interior Southern California, you could give some consideration to late planting of some of these types of really good fresh eating and slicing tomatoes. You'll have some going right on into the fall. And in the case of a couple of them, Bodacious, It's a Keeper, Chef's Choice Orange, those will hold on your counter for 2 to 3 weeks with no problem because they have a nice firm texture and they don't spoil quickly. So,
well, let's talk about the station. We have a station, KDRT. That's a wonderful station. Lots of people have lots of shows and a lot of them are local. So tell me about one of those shows, Don.
Well, one of the longest running shows is Davisville, where host Bill Buchanan presents stories that have some connection to Davis. It has won 13 Excellence in Journalism Awards from the San Francisco Press Club since 2018, plus a National Hometown Media Award for Excellence from the Alliance for Community Media in 2024. Just recently, Bill talked about the Davis Night Market, which offers free food every weeknight. Two pros, local political figures. We got a lot of them here because we're right near Sacramento. So a lot of people who work in politics in Sacramento like to reside in Davis. A couple of them came in, sat down as guests and chatted about local and statewide politics. That's just two of the recent programs on Davisville. It runs every week. It's on Mondays from 5:30 to 6 p.m. and rebroadcasts two times at least during the week. So for the rebroadcast schedule, just click on the schedule guide. That's Davisville with Bill Buchanan.
Okay, I want to talk now about some announcements. We always do the little PSAs. Patricia Carpenter is doing her fall ramble again, and she does these rambles every once in a while, and you are invited to enjoy Patricia's native garden on a typical cool fall day, if we have one. and the garden is described as a secluded 1-acre wild escape on the slough west of Davis. It's a Sunday, November 3rd from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. drop-in, rain or shine, and you RSVP is required. So go to the CNPS website, that's the California Native Plant Society website, and you can sign up.
It's actually a great place to go different seasons to see the seasonal nature of California native landscapes, because this is something new to a lot of people. I was talking to someone about it was a buckeye tree. They're wanting to know about buckeye. Would this be a good shade tree for my yard? And I said, yes, it would be a great shade tree until the middle of July when it drops all its leaves. So
the time you need shade, it isn't there.
It's a lovely tree. The flowers are cool. It is toxic to honeybees. So that's something to be aware of. And there are toxicity issues for people as well, but it's a cool tree in its place, but its adaptive strategy to our lack of irrigation and water in the summer is to simply drop its leaves. So it's bare. That's something you need to plan for. And there's a number of other native plants that have summer dormancy or may go into a period where they look stressed. Some of them you can water, some you shouldn't. And Patricia knows all that kind of stuff. So a great reference collection, lots of information.
And when you go there, as I said, it was a self-guided garden ramble. So you'll go there and you'll get a map. But if you want to actually listen to Patricia talk, there will be an optional short orientation with a Q&A session at 10 a.m. and at 12 noon.
Now, you mentioned it's on the slough, and I have to tell you that when I moved here, I had no idea what a slough was.
S-L-O-U-G-H, it means water in a ditch.
Slough, or it's spelled slough, which, as is it so often the case,
there's no F's in it.
Is another word that means something totally different. When your skin sloughs, that's a different thing. Slough is, I'm going to a dictionary here, a depression or hollow, usually filled with deep mud or mire, or a stagnant swamp, marsh, bog, or pond, especially as part of a bayou, inlet, or backwater. That's relevant here. Or a state of deep despair or moral degradation, which I don't think is relevant to this particular topic.
And in California, a slough is a channel filled with water. And it might be slowly moving, many sloughs are, or it might be not going very far, in which case we tend to call it a pond.
Or it's a stagnant swamp, marsh, bog, or pond.
So anyway, so other notes on, if you go to visit Patricia, wear sturdy shoes.
Yeah.
And no dogs, please. You can bring a snack or a lunch and eat there. That's fine. And she says, and the non-native garden will be open to view as well.
It's
So you can
lovely.
see the native garden or the other garden.
Yep.
All right, let's move on.
Yep.
All right, so we have a lot of people who write to us, and it's so wonderful to get your letters. Email is Don.
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com.
All right. And sometimes we'll get extra replies. So we talked to Tanya about her bottle brush situation and that fence she was trying to cover. And she wrote back, "Thank you again. I just donated $25 to KDRT. I'm glad these little bottle brush will still be okay."
Well,
So
thank you.
thank you
Thank
for
you. Thank
writing
you.
to us again, Tanya. And thank you for making that donation. You
You're
know,
welcome.
that's what keeps us going.
We always appreciate your contributions and your feedback. Okay,
Yes.
we have one thing I like to talk about this time of year very quickly is things you can plant right now because it's a confusing time of year for some people. They're perhaps moved to Northern California from colder climates or warmer climates, and they walk into a nursery like mine and see flats and flats and flats of vegetables and some flowers. And it's not uncommon for us to get a question like, won't these be harmed by the cold? Or more within the last 2 weeks, isn't it kind of hot to plant these? We always know that we're at the right time when we get those two questions on the same day. It was quite warm. We were just 2 weeks ago, or 10 days ago, we were over 100 degrees. And nevertheless, nurseries and hardware stores were selling winter vegetables because they do plant fine even when the temperature is high. That was one of the most common questions we were getting. Obviously, that's changed with this dramatic change in the weather, but it was okay to plant as long as you kept up on the watering. I do need to say you need to check newly planted plants every day, particularly when you're planting these types of things in August, September, October. They're going to dry out very quickly. And so gardening is a daily activity. Even if it's just a quick walk out there, something I found really handy years ago is to keep one watering can full of water. The last thing I do before I leave the vegetable garden is I fill it up with water again so that I can go out in the morning and I know it's going to be windy that day and I see that the plant is already a little droopy. I can just give it a quick watering before I leave. I don't have to turn on the system and water everything, just watering the individual plant. So keeping a watering can full out there, and that's going to be really important the day of the show and the day after the show. If you've already planted some of those things, sure, getting out a hose or turning on your system is great, but keep a close watch on the individual little plants. Another good reason to check them each day. There are caterpillars out right now. That white cabbage worm that flies around, the butterfly that your kids like to run after, pay your kids a penny a piece to run after them and kill them because they are ovipositing on your brassicas and they are going to hatch into little green caterpillars that will eat an awful lot of foliage. So that's one of the things you want to check daily because I can tell you that if you go out every like 5 or 6 days and they hatch out and you don't check them that quickly, you'll have a lot of leaves eaten off before you get around to doing whatever it is you're going to do about them. Brief segue into that. I have found just hand picking, just washing off the plants usually gives adequate control of the caterpillars, even though you're not necessarily killing all of them when you do that. It keeps the damage to a minimum. I don't feel like hauling out a sprayer and spraying anything, even an organic spray for caterpillars. Why not just hand pick them if you possibly can? Good news, we start getting into the 40s at night, they slow way down. We start getting below 40 at night, they practically stop. The vegetable plants keep growing, so they will outgrow them. But I would keep after them early on when they first hatch out. Poor little seedlings, you can see those holes forming. Turn the leaf over, and you'll see exactly the same color as the leaf, the little caterpillar of the cabbage worm, and just pick those off. But yes, when you're rinsing off plants for aphids and whiteflies, you'll knock off a lot of the eggs of these caterpillars and the little babies as well. But if you don't check daily, they can eat an awful lot before you finally get out there. Of the things that we can plant now, question?
I wanted to, okay. So before Don got on this topic, I was trying to flag him down so I could talk first because I wanted to bring to your attention, listeners, we have a great resource here. Don's business website, redwoodbarn.com, is incredible. And there are really nice articles there. I looked at a couple of them. One is the vegetable planting calendar, and that's a list of in which month you do what. Now, if you're looking at the calendar, the one at the pictures, It'll have the same thing on it, but this is a summary for the whole year. Then there's one called Food Plants for Fall. This is a Davis Enterprise article that Don wrote some time ago, and it is great. It is tells you what to plant, when to plant it, all that sort of things. But I got a bone to pick with you, Don. Oh, by the way, if you get to the bottom of this article and click on the link that says, what does it say, chart? Mm-hmm. Yes. There's a chart. If you click on that, you'll get to this cool, cool vegetable chart in the Sacramento Valley. And it tells you when you plant seeds, when you plant plants, and when they're going to be ready for harvest. It's really cool. Said that a couple times, didn't I? Yeah. But anyway, so this food we plant in the fall, this came out. It doesn't have a date on it, so I don't know how old it is. But I'm going down there, I'm reading it, I'm looking. And then I got all excited because down here in the peas, it says potatoes.
Yep.
Okay, so that means I can plant potatoes now to harvest in November. And I'm all excited. And then I called up the Don's place and I said, so can I come pick up potato seeds? Don, do you have potato seeds?
No. No, we don't.
Why not?
Spring. Well, a couple things. One is that what it says on the chart is you plant root pieces. I mean, you chop up a tuber August to September. In my opinion, September is late. This is based on my experience at this point.
And so, it's October now, huh?
So August, yes, you can plant. I first learned this from an organic farmer in the area. She was looking for seed potatoes in July because she'd run out and wanted to know if we had any source on them. And I said, well, I don't. But and I referred her to someone that I thought she could get them from. I said, seems like a late time to plant. She said, I plant. She's a farmer, hundreds of acres. I plant in July, August for the Thanksgiving market. And she gets new potatoes, small but very sweet potatoes. If she gets them in late July, August, in my opinion for that, September is getting late, but it's maybe worth a try. But I do get people coming into my garden center saying, looking for potatoes, this is when we plant them. And I'm thinking, where? where in the United States do you plant potatoes in the fall, September, October? There are places where it is done, where they're planted, and then they're covered with leaves. And then the snow covers the leaves, and then they stay nice down there in their cold but not freezing blanket, and they come up as early in the spring as the soil gets to the right temperature. So they plant them in the fall, and they come up in whatever spring is in that place. One article I read was from, I think, Connecticut. Okay, so a place where the soil gets good and cold after you plant them. I have done it here. When I first moved here, there were people telling you to plant potatoes in the fall. And when I would do it, they would come up right away, and then they would freeze back, as we expect. The frost will kill the tops of potatoes, and we get enough frost to do that. That still happens. And then they would resprout at some point in the late winter unevenly. So February, they might sprout up again. But, you know, a whole lot of them in anything approaching normal rainfall year would rot. And I just pretty quickly concluded after doing this a couple of times, this was not an efficient use of space or an efficient use of my time. I didn't get better results than I would get if I just waited until February, March, and went ahead and planted them in the normal pattern. But there are people who want to do this. So the problem we have here is it's too cold on top and too warm below. they do come up and the tops are frosted. Potatoes can take that. Think about the places potatoes are grown. Frost is not that unusual in the early stage of growth in Idaho or places like that, which are, you know, places that are famous for potato production. They freeze back, they resprout, they freeze back, they resprout. But if they freeze back because of cold weather and the soil is cold, the tuber will stay down there and just wait until spring. But if the soil is warmer, it will rot, or at least a significant percentage will rot. So some of you may have had good results with fall planting of potatoes. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe better results in drier winters, you know, some of the drought years. Or if you have a raised planter where it drains out rapidly and doesn't stay waterlogged. Problem there is that soil would stay warmer. So, you know, you've got the flip side is it might increase the likelihood of rot. Bottom line, it's not a good time to be looking for seed potatoes in nurseries. They're not available typically to us until February, March from the suppliers we get them from. You want to buy one in the grocery store? Well, the non-organic ones, the conventional ones, have been treated with a growth inhibitor. So they've been treated with something that it doesn't prevent sprouting completely, but it delays it. So you would need to wait for that to wear off before you plant it, which could be several weeks. So if you buy organic potatoes at the grocery store and cut them and plant them, they might work. They might rot. They might freeze. Depends on where you are, where you're listening, what your soil is like, and how the winter goes. It's not a very efficient use of time or space, as I said before. Also, one of the reasons for buying seed potatoes from a certified seed potatoes from a nursery, garden center, hardware store, certified means certified disease-free. And if you buy it as a potato at the grocery store, it's not disease-free. There's a pretty good possibility that you'll have something that could cause it to fail, to either get a disease on the stem or the potato itself to rot, bearing in mind that potatoes are particularly vulnerable to certain diseases, as we know from our history of immigration in the United States. So potatoes from the store might work. They need to be organic, untreated with respect to growth inhibitor, and you're taking a chance that they'll simply rot in the ground. I don't want to stop you from trying it. It might work if we have a mild winter and so on and so forth. You never know. But it's not something that I would consider. It's not the optimal time to plant potatoes. Everything else on that chart, I still agree with.
Okay, so if you are a gardener who has a big summer garden, and then in the winter you take it easy and you don't have very much out there, so this would be a good time to plant cover crops like fava beans or vetch or clover or annual ryegrass, any of those things. And October, mid-October, that's still fine to plant it, isn't it, Don?
Oh, all the way into December, depending on what it is. Very few people have as big a winter garden as they do summer garden. Yeah. Most of our summer vegetables are big, running, sprawling plants. Remember that tomato I was talking about at the beginning of the program? Well, it covered an area 6 feet across, you know, a full 6 foot diameter. On a cage, of course, you gain some space because you go vertical, but almost everything that you can think of, the major ones like cucumbers and squash and melons and tomatoes, run, and they take a lot of square footage. Winter vegetables are more discreet. They are typically not running things. There's one exception. Peas do need something to climb on. But all these other things that you can plant now, other than the cover crops, the coal crops, I mean, all the things we talk about, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, collards, kale, kohlrabi, all that kind of stuff. The lettuces and all of the leafy greens like arugula, spinach, beet greens, they can go in now. Beets, radishes, carrots, and turnips from seed. Believe it or not, some nurseries, including my own, sell some of those things in six packs, which seems odd to me, but some people want to buy them, so I do it. It's a good time to plant garlic. Onions will be arriving typically first or second week of November. And I think I covered most of them. But as you allude, there are other things you can be putting in just to cover space and prevent weeds and build the soil. And we call those cover crops. And the great, you know, the very best time to plant them, as with wildflower seeds, as with overseeding your lawn, is right before an actual rainstorm. Not a little drizzly, sprinkly rainstorm like we're getting today as we record the show. But when a half inch to an inch of rain is coming in, you walk out there with annual ryegrass if you're trying to choke out weeds, or crimson clover if you want something really beautiful that helps to build the soil, or you can stake fava bean seeds and just shove them in the ground anywhere where a tomato used to be. Just they're giant seeds. They're really easy to work with. And those are all things that will build the soil. And there's a lot of others. My favorite in recent years has been actually oats with peas. Regular old oats, although I buy one that's a little more vigorous, and then the field peas. I don't eat them. They're just out there to build the soil. And you get a solid mass of foliage from that. Really makes a lot of organic matter, biomass, and you just mow it. You know, the season is getting around to the time for planting tomatoes and other things. You just go out there and chop it down, mow it, let it lie there and break down, you know, pull it aside and plant your tomato plants in between the stubble. So what they do is they build the soil by adding organic material from the roots and the tops. Many of them enrich the soil by adding nitrogen. Most of them are extremely easy to grow and grow very quickly, even in cold weather. And if you're getting late, let's say it's December and you haven't planted your clover or your grasses or whatever, fava beans, I have stuck into the mud in January and had good results. So fava beans, which are one of the highest nitrogen-fixing legumes that you can plant, will make a great big plant by summer vegetable planting season, and you don't have to do any soil prep. You literally can chop down the tomato plant that you're done with, take two seeds of fava beans, shove them in the ground where the tomato plant was, and replace the tomato plant with a fava bean that way. Unlike other beans, they don't climb, they're freestanding. So they're just basically a nice big bed of something that's good for your soil. Yes, of course, many people do also eat the fava beans, but cover crops are something you can do anytime, October into December, and I've even planted fava beans as late as January with good results.
So if I were to get a bag of fava beans just to have for making cover crops and stuff, and I didn't use them all at once, how long will those store in my nice dry garage?
Yeah, store it at the right temperature in a place where there's not a lot of humidity. You'll lose some percentage of germination each year, but not much. And I have planted fava beans that were even a few years old and gotten very good results. If you're planting old seed, either pre-germinate it if you're really concerned about it, or plant extra. I mean, it's really that simple. And a lot of these are things, they're big. I mean, if you're doing a planting project with kids, you can't beat fava beans. The seeds alone are an inch across. So they're very easy to handle. They're easy to manipulate with small hands. They sprout almost no matter what you do. They're cute little plants. They grow rapidly and their flowers are really cool and fragrant. And then the beans are edible if you happen to like them. So it's really a great thing if you've got a big area that was in summer vegetables and you're only planting a few plants of broccoli or lettuce or whatever, just go ahead and fill the other areas with fava beans. Or, as I've done before, oats or annual ryegrass or some combination of those things. Probably the prettiest of the ones I've mentioned is clover, crimson clover, which is, although it's perennial, it's not heat tolerant, so typically functions as an annual here in the Sacramento Valley. You can just mow it as we get into hot weather and it tends to die out at that point. But before that has happened, it has these beautiful flowers that are very, very attractive, not just to pollinators, but to all kinds of beneficial insects. So clover is a great thing to have. I will say, my own experience is it's slower to get going, slower to cover. So I prefer to do it as a mix with other things or kind of on the edges of beds. If I really need to choke out weeds, I go with the more vigorous grasses, the fava beans, things like that. I'm going to mention vetch because a guy came in and asked for it, and I have sold it. I have planted it, and I regret it. It has seeded all the way down my property. It went into my orchard, and I'm making an effort to get rid of it now. It reseeds. What it does, like a lot of legumes, is when the seed pod splits, it sort of bursts. And so the seed sort of shoots 2, 3, 4 feet. And it did that for a couple of years. And the next thing I knew, it was everywhere. So will vetch can be a very good cover. And it's very, very pretty. Climbs on things. Keep that in mind when you plant it. It's going to kind of scramble up onto things. Very attractive to butterflies when it's blooming and bees. And does fix nitrogen. But you better mow it before it goes to seed. And honestly, I would just use a different cover crop personally.
All right. So there is a term which I hadn't been familiar with before, but and I now am. Yes. And it's for that area between the sidewalk and the street. It's that very long, skinny planting area there.
Yeah.
And Tara calls it a suicide strip. Yeah. Tara writes to us. Hi, Don and Lois. I recently moved to California and I am still getting to know the climate. We moved into a house on a canyon ridge in Oakland. There is a bed that overlooks the canyon, which is my prime sunny spot, where I want to put roses, dahlias, and such, but there are some hardy looking plants in it. I don't recognize a grass in it and I have attached some pictures. Could it be Carex paniculata? When is the best time to move these from there to someplace else? That's the first of her questions.
Okay, well, the best time to move them is right now, October, or alternative is spring. Now, I'm talking more for the valley. You mentioned this is more of a coastal climate. You can do it pretty much any time there as long as it's not extremely hot. But generally speaking, transplanting things, moving them around, digging and dividing perennials in this sedge, if that's what it is, is easiest done when the weather is mild. So October to early November or late February, March, April here in the valley. Cooler coastal climates, you know, my recollection is we weren't too fussy in coastal San Diego about exactly when we would dig and divide a perennial simply because it's never that hot on the coast. But just inland, just a couple miles, you can get quite hot. And I should mention, a week ago, they were setting record temperatures all over the San Francisco Bay Area. So that would not have been optimal. North wind coming in could affect you guys over the next couple of days. Once we're through that and into late October and November, that'd be a great time to divide it. So, and that goes for other hardy perennials. If you have subtropical plants, we generally do that spring or early summer, but this would be a good time.
So looking at the pictures, I see the grassy type leaves and then the inflorescence. Can you from that tell what this is? And there's a whole row of them along a fence in the back.
No, I cannot tell.
Cannot tell.
Cannot tell from that picture. Let me look a little closer and see if these are good pictures, so I appreciate it. That the and there's a term for this other than suicide strip, which is the hell
We
strip.
haven't got there yet.
Yeah, well, it is. It's an extreme environment. Let me see if I can zoom in a little closer here. Oh, this is Lomandra. Okay,
Is what?
Lomandra, Lomandra.
Is it a
Lomandra.
grass?
It is not a grass, actually.
It's a sedge.
It's a rush. The common
Oh,
name
it's a
of the
rush.
genre is mat rushes. Remember, reeds are round, sedges have edges. Okay, when you take your introductory botany class, they're dioecious. This is interesting. So you have different male and female plants, and they are really popular with designers right now. Why? Well, they're from Australia, and Australian plants tend to do extremely well here in California. And they generally very drought tolerant. So this has become a fairly trendy group of plants within the design industry because they're always looking for grass alternatives, things that give that accent appearance with the blade-like leaf, but that might be more drought tolerant, could be allowed to grow more naturally, sometimes have attractive flowers, sometimes not. This particular one, I urge you to look closely at the flower. And Lois, are you looking at that picture?
I am looking at that flower.
The little spines on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so some of them have thorny flower spikes. So that is something to be aware of.
So if you brushed against it, you could not be happy.
It would discourage you from walking through there, which might be desirable along a sidewalk strip,
Okay,
depending
now
on your
let's,
use. So
we
we can
haven't
talk,
gotten to the
we
sidewalk yet.
didn't get that in a minute, but this the Lomandra group, there's two plants that we could talk more about, Lomandras and Dianellas, which are iris-like or grass-like, but they are neither irises nor grass. And they give a similar effect, and they're generally planted where you won't need to prune them. There are variegated forms, shiny green ones, golden-leafed ones. In the years I've been in business, we've gone through groups of plants that are in this category. The grasses became really popular in the 80s and 90s, so many that it was overwhelming, ornamental grasses. Phormiums, the New Zealand flax became very popular in the 90s and for the next decade. And some of them are huge and some were small. And then we've gotten into these Dianellas and Lomandras as kind of the latest, what I'll call trend in accent plants. Mass plantings of these going in where designers will spec 10, 20, 30 of them on 1 foot or 2 foot centers to make what looks like a giant meadow. And they are very meadow-like in their appearance, and they're very tough and
But
adaptable.
they're tall.
Some of them are tall, some are short.
Yeah.
It's a diverse group. They don't need pruning. Please, maintenance gardeners, stop pruning these things. That's been a huge problem with ornamental grasses over the years that people put in huge areas in grasses, and then the maintenance crews think, well, we have to prune these one by one and go in and shear them off, and it just looks terrible. In general, if it's a grassy looking plant or an iris looking plant, you generally shouldn't need to prune it. So find out if there's some reason for pruning it before you just go in and automatically assume you do. But anyway, great group of plants, Lomandra.
Okay, so the picture shows a backyard overlooking the canyon. There's a fence behind it. It's a wire and wood fence, so you see through fence. And then there's this strip, and I see eight of these plants in that strip. And she's going to be taking out all eight of those plants. So, and putting in the roses and the other things she was talking about. So that's the source. Now, let's come to the second question. The full sun suicide strip at the front of our house is empty, except for an annoying layer of rocks put down by the previous owners. And it's pea gravel. It's not big rocks, it's little rocks. And on that back strip, there was pea gravel as a underneath the plants there too. Okay. It's unirrigated, and sometimes I don't want to bother something. I don't want to bother with watering more often than every 3 to 4 weeks would be good after a year of establishing the plants. Would reusing the what'd you call that? A Lomandra?
Lomandra,
Lomandra?
Lomandra. Yep.
Would reusing the Lomandra and kangaroo paws from my other bed work here? I
Yes.
also have some potted plumeria trees that are not, I'm not sure will handle the canyon winds in my backyard. Would they work here?
Okay, we'll take these one at a time. I'd be a little concerned about the plumerias and the wind. Now you're in a climate where you can actually grow them outdoors, unlike where we're broadcasting from. But you're probably best keeping those in containers or a place perhaps closer to the house.
So she was saying that in the backyard, It's windy because of the canyon, but in the front yard on the street, it's not as windy.
So just shelter them from the wind. The plumeria leaves can burn if they're in drying winds. Again, less of an issue in that climate than here, but that would be one consideration.
Okay.
But yeah,
And
the
then,
other plants, I'll mention kangaroo paw. Someone liked these Australian perennials. Enigoxanthus, one of my favorite plant names. Enigoxanthus, you want to say gesundheit when someone says Enigoxanthus. There's a bunch of these, and they're also accent perennials that have really iris-like foliage and really interesting fuzzy flowers. That's the best way I can describe them. And they range from 2 foot to 6 foot high. Colors are typically in the warm range. All they need is pretty good drainage. Beyond that, they're drought tolerant, they're sun loving. They can take light shade if they have to. And hummingbirds absolutely love the flowers. So they're a very cool plant. And again, designers are mass planting them. I noticed this when I was visiting my parents in Southern California 10, 20 years ago. Huge areas, 20, 30 of them going in for a mass planting, which is quite spectacular. And they do bloom over a very long period, but they also make a really nice focal point, just like a single plant surrounded by lower fescue grasses or something like that. So keep that in mind as you move them. Maybe not so many of them all close together. Maybe give them a little more room for each plant to develop to its full potential. Some are big and need that room. Others, it would just be a matter of, your decision-making process.
So are the kangaroo's paws also thorny and problematic for walking against or brushing through?
No.
So I'm a little concerned if you put this out in the sidewalk strip that anybody who gets out of a car is going to have to be brushing up against this Lamandra.
Yeah, we will talk about that in a moment. So, yeah, anyway, continue.
Okay, so that would be a problem. Okay, at my home in Georgia, which is where she moved from, we had planted columnar apples, but I'm not guessing they will need more watering than I want to do here.
Yes,
Is that true?
apples are high water fruit trees, no question
Yeah.
about it. And my experience is this isn't really apple country, folks. I mean, apples grow here and there are varieties that do well. Sure, Fuji, Gala,
They're
Brady,
better up in the
some of those.
mountains.
They just, the three that I mentioned, I'm happy to sell because they do perform well here. But apples, if I were planting a small family orchard and I was concerned about water usage, they wouldn't be a high priority for me. I would be focusing on the stone fruits and the others because apples just, if you're from apple country, you've had better apples and you're going to grow here. There you
Yeah, absolutely.
go.
Yeah. Okay, I would like, she continues, I would like some low water recommendations of plants to put in the strip that stay under 3 feet. Bonus points for anything highly prolifer fro highly floriferous
Floriferous.
flower covered,
Yes, there you
such as
go.
lantana maybe, which can be used for cut flowers, maybe proteas, but fragrant or tasty or
Oh,
native.
proteas, yes.
My husband loves lantana and would appreciate knowing if it is a good candidate. And then after I plant, what do I do with the odious rock mulch?
Yeah, well, that's that. We can start with that, actually. Taking it out is really a hassle. I always discourage people from using rock mulch. It's fairly permanent. It doesn't benefit the soil except by shading it, and it'd be better to put something that slowly decomposes. And all right, rocks slowly decompose, but we're talking about geologic time scale. So something that would decompose within, I don't know, our lifetime. Compost, fine bark, and compost is even better than bark in that regard. But it's there, and very commonly, when I would be advising on this kind of situation, the first question is, do I need to take out all the rock? No, just cover it. Just plant something that'll grow over it, unless you want to take on that labor of pulling it out or pay someone to do so. When we were landscape contractors, removing rock was one of the most difficult things for me to estimate. It always took longer than I expected. But there are lots of creeping ground covers and lots of different kinds of flowering plants that would work in these sidewalk strips, hell strips. The issue with them in the valley is they're typically not irrigated. So if you bought a house in Davis and you have the sidewalk strip, which is the area, it's part of the city's easement, but you of course are allowed to plant it. Very commonly, these were installed without any watering system. So your plants either are going to have to be hand watered or you're going to have to put in things that can go with very, very limited irrigation. There are very few plants that can live all summer with no irrigation. And here we'd have fewer choices than there. So first, if you're interested in California natives and things that would not need irrigation at all, head on over to calscape.org. It's a project of the California Native Plant Society. Type in your zip code and up will come an amazing array of plant selections from just things native to your zip code. So that's one thing I want to put out there before we talk about all these cool non-native plants. Your partner likes lantana. Well, it's a great choice. It definitely does very well almost everywhere in California. And you have a whole lot of new ones to work with. When I was growing up, lantana was a great big sprawling plant. The variety Radiation, Dallas Red, some of the others out there got easily 6 feet across, 5 to 6 feet tall. Here in the valley, they freeze back and they regrow to 5 to 6 feet just within a single season. So it's a big plant. But there are now, and have been for a long time, ground cover forms that hug the ground and stay short enough to meet your criteria. They're Lantana montevidensis is the old name. Celloiana is the new name. These are prostrate forms of Lantana. The only issue actually will be they'll try to grow out of the sidewalk strip because they do spread quite vigorously. Purple, white, and a new one called New Gold, which is yellow. Single plant of New Gold got 6 feet across in one season for us a couple of years ago when it first came on the market. I decided to try it. I've seen some great plantings of this one. But again, a sidewalk strip is usually 4 feet wide. It wants to spread to 6 feet. So the one issue with the old-fashioned forms or the ground cover forms of Lantana is that they will need to be pruned to keep them within the sidewalk strip.
So Lantana is a beautiful flower, but there is another flower that is low growing and looks like Lantana. Pop quiz, Don, what is it?
They're probably talking about verbena, which is
I'm talking about verbena.
Well, let's back up to Lantana before we jump to verbena because
I want to mix them.
There are now, well, you can't mix anything with the first types of Lantana that I mentioned. If you happen to come to the Redwood Barn Nursery on Fifth Street or stop by the DMA studios next door, you'll see some Lantana, old-fashioned kind, that were planted there. And it gets over the window and out over the sidewalk, and the maintenance crew that comes along there every couple months prunes it back just to keep it off the sidewalk. So there would be a fair bit of that. So nothing is going to be growing with those, but there are new forms of Lantana. Some of you in even much colder climates will be seeing these in garden centers because they're actually selling them as bedding annuals in places where they freeze. These are dwarf types, and they got a bunch of names like Lucky Pot of Gold, and there's a bunch of series out there. They get about 2x2, maybe 3x3 in the course of one growing season. Here, we're in USDA zone 9. You're probably in USDA zone 10. Here, they freeze back. So we get leaf damage and some top injury, but they always resprout. So you just cut off the dead stuff in the spring when they start to sprout, and they get back to about 2 to 3 feet equal spread. In the coastal areas, they don't defoliate, but they benefit from a pruning anyway. But they would stay within the bounds of your area. So these dwarf types of Lantana would be less work for you. They'll also be a lot slower to fill in. And if you want to put in some brightly colored things like, I don't know, verbena comes to mind, you could mix them and you'd have a nice combination of flowers over a very long period. There's lots of other flowers you could mix with the dwarf Lantana. If you go the old fashioned kind, you're just going to fill that bed with Lantana is what you're going to do. And it'll get big enough and woody enough that someone parking on the street is not going to walk through it to get to your house. They'll walk around it because it is enough of a barrier. The dwarf types, you might have a little bit more of an issue of people stepping on them.
So I see in your picture that you have stepping stones so that people from the street can step across the stones to get to the sidewalk. So that would be fine. I have for years had this wonderful idea in my head that I've never had the place to put it because you need a long skinny strip for this idea, and that is making waves of color. So in my thought, it was white verbena, white lantana, which is low, white lantana, medium size, and then a crepe myrtle tree, which is tall, and that was your white wave. And then you'd do repeat pink lantana, pink verbena, pink lantana, and a pink crepe myrtle tree. And that would be your second one. Then you repeat them. But since you don't want trees, you could do a short wave with just having verbena come up to the lantana and then verbena come up to the lantana and have that sort of cyclic pretty wave kind of thing.
Sure. Now this what we're describing here would require a couple times a year trimming and grooming to keep it from running over the sidewalk. You will find there's a lot of ground covers that'll fit in that particular type of exposure that would require less maintenance on your part. One that's become very popular in the Bay Area is Diamondia. And it does grow here, although we get a little cold damage on it and people tend to overwater it. But it looks like a miniature gazania for those of you who know gazania, which is also a good choice out there. Gazanias would love that kind of sun. And at least in the sunnier areas in the interior, they'll be blooming for a very long period. New hybrid gazanias typically last about 2 years and give a lot of bloom in that time. And then you just pop in new ones. There's also ground cover forms that have been around forever that hug the ground. So there are options there. Daimondia, gazania, some of the fescues with the silver foliage, snow in summer, which has silver foliage as well, is a quick cover. It'll need to be trimmed back every now and then, but it has fuzzy silver gray leaves. One that we've used in a retirement community where we needed something right along the edge, but we didn't want it running over, was the old-fashioned lamb's ears, Stachys. And we've used a type that stays very compact, but there are big ones as well. So those are all things with silver foliage, some seasonal flowers that stay under 2 feet. There are lots of shrubs that would do what you're after as well. And some of them are prostrate shrubs. So we get into the, what's the difference between a shrub and a ground cover? A good example would be Myoporum parvifolium, which is a rapid spreading shrub that is very drought tolerant, that hugs the ground, very popular here in the valley. You'd have to trim it because it's going to run over the sidewalk. So be aware of that. But there are plants that will give you some bloom, give you some interesting textured foliage. Look for silver gray type foliage, or you could just fill it up with that Lomandra if you don't mind putting something a little prickly out there. And there are also grasses that would do the job. It kind of depends on whether you're trying to keep people from walking across there or don't care if people walk across there. I helped someone who had one of these sidewalk strips in downtown Davis, right near the university. So a little cottage area with very heavy foot traffic, bikes and students on foot walking through all the time. Everything they planted out there just got trampled to death. So we used deer grass. Deer grass is a California native grass. It gets about 4x4. And once it's established, you're not going to walk through it. So we took that, this Muhlenbergia ridgens, and it's a great, one of the attractive grasses. It actually looks great through the summer, even if it's unirrigated, and looks better if you irrigate it. Doesn't need to be pruned back at all. Gardeners like to do it, but you don't have to do that. Each plant gets easily 3 feet across and 3 feet tall. So it might be a little bigger than what you're looking for here. It can get up to 4 feet, but it's a big, robust, sturdy, deep-rooted, drought-tolerant native grass. It'll hold its own against almost anything. And that was the one thing that we did in that downtown high traffic area that really held up. They also did what you've done. They put step stones in. So for at least the kind of people who are polite, they had a place to walk where they weren't stepping on things. And we did stick in some succulents like sedum and some ground covers, and most of those got trampled to death, but the grasses held their own. And the other grass that has worked in these settings, as long as they're somewhat protected by either larger rock or another bigger plant, are some of the little fescues, the little gray fescue, blue fescue, little tufty silvery grasses that you see in a lot of landscapes. They held up surprisingly well. But boy, deer grass definitely held its own. Another plant that really held its own, and in fact will take over, California fuchsia. It's Auchinaria, or Epilobium is how it's now classed. There are a bunch of different kinds. I have seen them fill these kinds of strips very effectively. They only bloom midsummer through fall. So you'd want to combine them with something that looks nice in the spring, like, I don't know, daffodils or something like that. Many of them will choke out anything else in that bed. I would say that if you put in dwarf lantana and California fuchsia, I'd put my money on the California fuchsia winning that battle in the long run. But if you put in a more robust lantana, or look for some of the lower growing types of California fuchsia, you might have a compatible combination there.
And if you're the artistic type, as I am, I would love to decorate your strip here, because there's something called red apples, which is a succulentish kind of a thing, and it when it blooms, the entire area is covered with magenta colored flowers. I mean, and it is as flat, this is low. Mm-hmm. So if you did like a square of that, and then you did a square of, oh, I don't know, the really short lamb's ears, so it's gray and fuzzy, and then maybe you did a square of what about that dark green grass that we've got? That would be pretty. So doing like a patchwork down the strip, you know, but hey, that's me. I'm getting artsy.
Well, the Aptinia also, I should mention, here in the valley, it freezes. So it looks rough in the wintertime. When it's in bloom, it's absolutely covered with bees. But in the Bay Area, it does not freeze back. You will have to trim it off the sidewalk, I guarantee. But if you like that look, There are some lower growing ice plants. And there's a funny phenomenon where I'll be talking to someone about plants for a hot, sunny area, and I'll mention ice plant, and they recoil as if I'm suggesting that one that's planted along the freeway. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Not the big old ice plant that you see along the Caltrans planted so much of over the years. Delospermas, and in coastal areas, Lampranthus. These are ice plants that have a very low, tight growth habit. You can actually step on them if it comes to that. If someone steps on them now and then, like the mailman or something, that'll be absolutely fine. They'll come back from that. And they typically have very nice blooms, and you just need to look into their hardiness depending on where you're listening. So Delospermas were introduced by the Denver Botanical Garden. We can grow them here with no problem. Lampranthus, which I remember from Southern California, freezes below sunset zone 15, about 31, 30 degrees. You get a fair bit of injury on it. So you may be listening in a place where you can grow those really showy flowered ice plants like the Lampranthus types, or if you're here in the valley, you would probably be better off going to the Delospermas, which are more elegant and refined and flatter growing. There are succulents that'll work in your situation, and actually a really nice combination, if there's not too much foot traffic, is things like hen and chicks with some of the grasses, with some of the other plants we're talking about. Sort of a mixed planting chosen with plants chosen for foliage, texture, hardiness, and enough different things that if one of them just doesn't work out because you have more traffic than you thought, or just you can't get water out there for whatever reason, they don't prove to be as drought tolerant, you have diversity. And we always recommend a diversity of species to cover your bases. Long droughts without any hand watering, would some of the things we talked about, wouldn't do real well. But all you would really need to do for all the things we've discussed in your climate, every 2 weeks, take a hose out there and give everything a thorough washing and soaking, or run a drip line or a soaker hose so you can water it. And once established, as little as once a month would be fine for most of the things we've talked about.
So Don, when this came up in the mailbag, you sent me an article called Plants for Sidewalk Strips .doc. Is this something that's available on the website?
No. It's exclusive to Davis. It's exclusive to Davis Garden Show listeners.
Whoa. I guess if somebody wants it, they could write to us and say, I really need that sidewalk strip.
We could do that.
Article, huh? You could do that.
Okay. We could do that.
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com is the place to send us your questions, your comments, your successes. We always want to hear about what you did and how it worked out.
Okay.
All right. Well, we usually close our show with a quote. And today, I got this one. It was a signature line from one of our listeners that had written in. And the quote is, to plant a garden is to believe in tomorrow. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't believe in tomorrow if you're not a gardener. I mean, the obverse is not true. It's just, if you're going to be a gardener, you better believe in tomorrow.
There you go. You're planning now, planning and planting for what you're going to be eating 6 to 12 months down the road, or enjoying as flowers. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.